Not thinking about anything is Zen. Once you know this, walking, standing, sitting, or lying down, everything you do is Zen. To know that the mind is empty is to see the Buddha. Using the mind to look for reality is delusion. Not using the mind to look for reality is awareness. Freeing oneself from words is liberation. Welcome to the Alchemical Mind. It's been several months since I recorded an episode, and I could bore you with the details of why that is, but we're not going to do that because, after all, that's not what we do on the show. After all, if I started going through my work schedule or my home schedule, my family schedule, etc., that would be boring. It would be simply concepts and not at all an aspect of the reality. And the reality is that I've been a little on and off over the past year, really, in order to internalize a lot of the things that I've been exploring and learning over the past few years doing this podcast and even before. And one thing that I realized is oftentimes I would find myself doing this show simply to do the show, simply because people expected to get a new episode of the podcast. And that wasn't real to me. That wasn't real. It was putting an expectation on something that I began simply as a journey of self-exploration. And as the months have gone by, the podcast has grown and grown and grown. Even now that I haven't put out an episode in months, the podcast is still quite popular. I decided to take a little time for introspection, to truly analyze what it is that I had learned, what I had experienced. And honestly, it's kind of funny that I began this episode with a Zen quote, because really when the podcast began, I was exploring heavily the art of Zen and many non-dualist philosophies. And so it's kind of apropos that we could start there. Last week, my daughter came up to me and was telling me about all these people that she hates at school and why she hates them. One person in particular who kind of purposely demeans her. And she told me what this person would say and the way that she would react and how mad it would make her and this, that, and the other. And I just listened. And I listened. And I listened. And finally she got done telling her story and she asked, "Well, do you have nothing to say to me?" And the only thing I could think to say was that I loved her. Now you could think that's a really simple thing to do for a parent to tell their kid that they love them. Anybody could do that, right? I would assume most of you that are parents love your children. If not, then you probably simply hate yourself. But that's all I could tell her, because that's really all she needed to hear. Because when I told her that, she had nothing to say. And a couple hours went by, and she came back to me, and she said, "You know, I appreciate what you told me earlier, but what do I do?" And so I went through all the examples of what this person was saying to her, and I asked her, "Is this true?" "Yes." "Is this true?" "No." "Are you friends with this person? Does it matter what they think of you?" "No, no." "So why are you getting so worked up about it if what they're saying isn't true and means nothing to you?" And she thought about it for a minute and she said, "Well, maybe some of that stuff is true." And then we could really get into a discussion, because see, then we could discuss what the actual problem was. The problem wasn't that she was getting bullied by somebody. The problem was that this person, the things that this person was saying to them, had some spark of truth to it. And because it had some spark of truth to it, it really affected her. So I asked her, "When are you most happy? What is it that you're doing when you're most happy?" And she said she really loved it when she played soccer. She's a goalie. She's been playing goalie for years. She loves playing soccer. Football for the international crowd. So I asked her, "When you're playing soccer, what is it that you feel?" "I just feel happy," she said. "I feel overjoyed. I feel like I'm doing something with myself. I feel like nothing else matters. All that matters is the game." So I asked her, "What's the difference between that moment and the moment when you're faced with someone bullying you?" And she thought about it and thought about it. And finally she said, "I'm not having fun when I'm being bullied. That's the difference. It's pretty obvious, Dad." So what you're telling me is that when you do something that you enjoy, that you want to do, you're overjoyed And when you're doing something that you don't want to partake of, you hate it. You feel saddened or angry. Yes. Now, what if you could turn that experience into one that brought you joy? Would you do that? And she looked at me kind of strange, obviously. How could being bullied bring me any sort of joy? And I asked her, what if you could live every moment of your life as if you were playing that game? Now, I use this as an example because obviously it's very real life. If you have children or a spouse, boyfriend, girlfriend, a parent, a friend, maybe somebody you randomly meet on the street where you end up having an argument about whatever it might be. Maybe some conspiracy theory or some political stance that you hold or some religious stance that you hold or a stance that you hold on a medical issue. You might feel like you're not really having too much fun when you're arguing with somebody and they just don't seem to listen. They can't seem to grasp the truth. But really, ultimately, why does it matter if you win? And see, this is one of the problems we have with language, because even if you tell someone to treat life as a game, they immediately think that a game must have a winner, and a game must have a loser. Just like if I start talking about God or infinite circles, you automatically get an image in your mind of what God looks like, or what this circle looks like. But you see, even though you are all of it, you could never achieve that level of insight because you are not that thing. I've often brought up the example of, I love watching my dogs, one in particular, the older one, because sometimes she just sits and stares. And as humans, we like to personify things. So, you know, oftentimes I'll sit on the couch and I'll start watching something, usually a horror movie. I love horror flicks. I love science fiction. So something to that effect. And she'll come and sit next to me because she knows I'm going to be sitting still. And so she can sit next to me because the dog appreciates my company. All the dog cares about is that I'm next to the dog, that I'm rubbing the dog, that I'm petting the dog. Maybe that I talk to the dog, even though the dog has no idea what the words coming out of my mouth actually mean. It knows that my attention is centered on it. And even if we're just simply watching a movie, just the act of sitting there together is enough for the dog. But again, we like to personify things. So sometimes my wife will come into the room and we'll be watching a movie and she'll come to the dog and start talking to the dog and say, oh my God, like she loves watching these movies with you. The dog doesn't care about watching the movie. The dog has no idea what's going on in the movie. As far as the dog knows, the dog is, it's the same as if the dog were sitting outside by my driveway next to the fence, watching cars drive by on the street. There is no difference to the dog. All the dog knows is, I live in this home, I watch out for this home, and I want to make my owner happy. I want to be part of this family. And sure, there may be some selfish thoughts that arise, obviously not selfish because again we're personifying, but some thoughts where the dog wants its basic needs met. The dog wants to be let outside so it can use the bathroom. The dog wants to be called in to eat. The dog wants to be pet. The dog wants to be walked. And so it does things in order to get those things that the dog wants. But the dog isn't actively pursuing these things. The dog isn't sitting there thinking, oh my God, if I don't watch the street and make sure that these people are safe, they're not going to let me in the house. That's not going to happen. The dog's not thinking, if I don't do my job, if I don't sit next to this person, he's not going to feed me. The dog doesn't think that. Now that drive lives within it because it's a living being. Living beings have certain drives, certain things that they need to survive. But there's no active thought there. There's no wish fulfillment. There's no thinking, will I eat at 3 o'clock or at 6 o'clock? See, that in essence is this Zen mind that I began the episode with. And it is this Zen mind that we should use on a day-to-day basis. Several episodes ago, I talked about my removing certain practices from my life. One of them being meditation, active meditation. Sitting down in the quiet, maybe with my headphones, some music or whatever, sitting out in the woods behind the house, anything like that, and spending some time doing these meditations. And some folks sent me emails. They don't understand. How is it that you can talk about these things? How is it that you can achieve closeness to the divine without doing some kind of discipline, without doing the meditation or a prayer or reading or some magical ritual or some alchemical concoction? And the answer very simply is that you don't need to do that once it goes from being a discipline to a way of life, where you don't need to be sitting or laying down or eating some mushrooms or smoking DMT or reading the Quran or reading the Yetzirah Sephirah or any of these texts or anything. It doesn't matter. Because see, when you devote your time to doing these things, yes, you can learn something. Of course you learn something. And thoughts will arise that will lead you to search for the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. So there's nothing inherently wrong with trying to perform any of these practices. But the problem becomes when you feel like you have to perform these practices. Because see, then you are not being it. Then you fail to realize the divine essence that lives inside you, that you are, because you're it, right? Every episode I've ever done always ends the same way. You are it. You are it. All of it. And I don't do it as a nice way to end the episode. I could care less if the episode comes out sounding nice, if you like what I say. It's irrelevant to me. I do it as a mantra, as a practice. Not just because it's something that I need to practice, but something that I truly, deeply believe with every fiber of my being, with all of my essence. That not just am I it, but that you are it, you're all of it, every aspect of it. And sometimes it saddens me when people get so bogged down by all these concepts around their daily lives. They make their lives so terribly difficult that they fail to see that. See, one of the essential tenets of Buddhism is that life is suffering. And sometimes in a Western perspective, we believe once we maybe decide to branch out from our traditional upbringing, say in a Christian church, we believe that what this means, life is suffering, is that there's no way out of it. Life sucks. That's the way many people read it. Life sucks. Get over it. And this, of course, comes from the basic way that we are raised, where we have shaped our society to be a cult of suffering. If you go to your Bible, for example, from the very beginning of humankind, all we have known is suffering. And whose fault is it? Well, depends who you ask. Usually it's the woman's fault. Sometimes it's the snake's fault. Sometimes it's God's fault. Sometimes it's a false God's fault, right? The demiurge, we've talked about Gnosticism quite a bit. There's always somebody else's fault. But whose fault is it really if you live your life in suffering but your own? You have no one to blame for your suffering but yourself. Now, you might live in a society where this is reinforced in magical, airy-fairy tales that make you feel like, well, it's okay, just endure through the suffering, and then maybe the next go-around, you'll feel better. So if you look at the caste system, for example, within Hindu society, you might see this more often, where maybe you're a pariah, an outcast, because in your previous life, you did something terrible. You gathered up terrible karma, and the universe is punishing you. But it's okay, because if you work through it, if you try to cleanse your karma when you are reborn in the next go-around, it'll be better. And we have this same in Christianity. It's okay if your life sucks. It's okay if you're poor. It's okay if your life sucks, if your job sucks, if your family hates you. It's okay because God loves you. And if you truly believe in God, then after you die, everything's going to be perfect and you're going to go into heaven. Or you see this within some of the Muslim sects where it's okay to do terrible things, because Allah will reward you when you die with 72 virgins. It's all bullshit. It's all conceptual fallacies. None of this is real. None of it is real. It's all a way to prevent you from realizing your true essence. And what is that? That you are it. It's very simple. It's very simple. Why do we complicate these things? Why do we complicate these things? You know, I could come on this podcast and I could start talking and give an introduction and I could do, I could be like one of the Zen monks, a Zen master. I could come in here and I give you a quote and, we sing a song, maybe we do a prayer and then... And that's the end of it. Because see, if you don't get it, you don't get it. That's the basic fact. If you refuse to realize the magic beauty that is existence, you just won't get it. But maybe when you hear that, maybe then you wake up. Maybe then you wake up. Maybe then you'll see it's all bullshit. And it's especially bullshit because you buy into it. If you are an aspect of divine existence, what do you have to worry about? You can use whatever word you want. You can phrase it any way you want. You can see yourself as an aspect of Brahma. You can see yourself as a child of light. Maybe you're a child of darkness. Maybe Shiva watches over you. Maybe the Buddha watches over you. Maybe the Lord guides you in your way. It doesn't matter how you look at it. The essence is still the same. All those things are conceptual fallacies. If you're young, let's say you're 4 or 5 years old and a family member dies, okay? And you go to this funeral as a young child and you see everyone at the funeral begins crying. Oh my God, how terrible this person died. That's what they say. And you don't know any better. This is the first time you've seen someone die. This is the first time you've been to a funeral. This is the first time you've seen reaction to death. Maybe it's the first time you've seen a dead body, right? If there's an open casket funeral. Maybe it's your first time. And you have no framework for dealing with any of this. And so what happens is you internalize these reactions. Oh, so when someone dies, I'm supposed to be sad and cry and be ashamed that I'm still alive. And so when it happens again, you have the framework. And you react to this event within that framework. And so you begin to cry. You wear, a black suit. You go, you cry, you have to hug people, right? Because people want to feel better, so you hug them. And the hugging makes you feel good as well. But is any of that real? Does any of that matter? And some of you might be taken aback by that. What do you mean? Of course you have to be sad when someone dies. They're not with you anymore. Aren't they? You see all these contradictions in all sorts of belief systems. Oh, this person's watching over you because they're dead now, so they're watching over you. But when they die, you go and cry. Well, which one is it? Because if they're watching over you, they're still with you. So why are you sad? Shouldn't you celebrate the life? Shouldn't you celebrate the memories that you have with this person to make a stronger bond, a stronger connection, instead of disassociating yourself from it? And the same works with spiritual practice of any sort. So going back to prayer or meditation or ritual magic or anything else that you might do in your daily routine, I'm not saying don't do these things. Do whatever works for you. If you get something out of it, great. But wonder what exactly is it that you're getting out of it. Because part of the reason that I've decided to kind of keep quiet over the past year as much as I have, is that you begin to get this feeling of wanting, where maybe you go and you do a trip and you see these crazy things, you have these vivid dreams, maybe you see actual entities, however you want to denote it. You're in these beautiful landscapes, or maybe you do breathwork meditation and you begin to feel different than you do on your normal day to day. And you say, well, holy crap, I must be getting somewhere. Or you go and you do a 7-day fast, a 10-day fast. And the changes in your body make you feel more level-headed, more clear, more aware of things. And you say, my God, this practice is incredible. Or you go and do a meditation retreat. You go into the woods for a week, 10 days, 2 weeks, 30 days, whatever long. And you just sit there and meditate. And you say, my God, I feel so much closer to you. Isn't that just preposterous that we would have these thoughts? Have you considered what you're doing to yourself? All you're doing is placing a veil right before your eyes as the universe is trying to lift it. It's like going on social media, knowing that something's going to piss you off, but you go on there anyway so you can get that feeling. Oh my God, I'm so pissed. Can't believe the government's hiding aliens, or I can't believe there's satanic cults governing the planet. I can't believe Democrats did this, or Republicans did this, or Jews did this, or Muslims did this, or Christians did this, or Nazis did this, or the anti-vaxxers did this, or the pro-vaxxers did this. It's all bullshit. You are miring yourself in bullshit. You are covering yourself in it, because none of it matters. But of course, you do need to partake in these practices and these disciplines in order to see how much bullshit you cover yourself in. Last year, I did a somewhat short meditation retreat. I don't know if I would call it necessarily meditation because I didn't meditate the entire time that I was there, but I went out into the woods by myself. I set up in a tent up on a mountain and I just existed. And the first day of doing that was quite possibly the longest day of my life. And it was the longest day of my life because there was all this chatter in my brain. I should be doing this. I should be doing that. What if I do this practice? What if I do that practice? What if an animal comes out in the woods? What if a bear attacks? What if I run out of food? What if I don't have water? What if I can't sleep? What if I'm uncomfortable? Chatter. Chatter, chatter, chatter. None of it matters. And you begin to see that as you get into day 2, day 3, and day 4, where the chatter slowly begins to dissipate. Because see, what you're doing is you're removing this brainwashing that you've done to yourself your entire life. You don't do it on purpose. Some of you might. But most of you don't do it on purpose. You don't purposely brainwash yourself. Sometimes, yes, it is easier to believe certain things in order to make your life easier, because after all, who loves suffering? No one loves suffering. No one loves suffering. I mean, maybe if you're a sadomasochist, you love suffering. But you love suffering because it brings you pleasure. So really, it's two sides of the same coin. All you're after is pleasure. All you want is for your life to be simpler. And if the Buddha achieved enlightenment by, you know, going off and doing his thing and finding the middle path, or if Jesus achieved enlightenment by going to the desert for 40 days and 40 nights, or whatever figure you want to bring up, then maybe that's what you should do as well. Maybe that's what you need to do. Then you can achieve the state which these people you admire achieved. But why is it that you admire them? You know nothing about them. As far as you know, they never existed. Now, of course, if you're entrenched in a particular belief system, you might say, well, how dare you say such and such didn't exist? That's the founder of my spiritual belief system. That may be, but is that reality? Is that real to you right now? Is that person with you right now? And maybe you say, well, of course, Jesus is always with me. I've seen him in dreams. I've had visions. Is that true? Is that true? Or are you simply trying to rationalize your belief? Because I promise you that once you begin to see that whether you're walking, standing, sitting, or lying down, you're always in Zen, or you're always in God, or any figure you want to use, then none of that matters. All you're doing is touching different parts of the elephant and creating a concept, a visualization of what that part might be. And you could be completely wrong. Because regardless of how much we try to alienate others in order to prove ourselves to be correct, there's only one absolute truth. And that truth is that you are it. You are this. You come into existence with a bang and dissipate to nothingness as time progresses. And for some reason, you identify this with you. That's not you. Just like that is not a sound. that they always have the saying that the five colors make you blind and the five tones make you deaf. And what that means is very simple, is that you walk around the world, you look at things, and you try to name them. Those of you that are steeped in Kabbalah, for example, might be familiar with this concept. If you're into Christian mysticism, you might be familiar with this concept. If you're into ritual magic, you're definitely familiar with this concept. It's where we get the word spell from, because if you spell the true name of things, then you have control over them. Why? Why do you need to control them? They are you, and you are it. What's to control? It is through trying to control things that you fail to grasp them. Life is like a river. If you go down to the river because you're thirsty, sure, you can get some water into your hand and put into your mouth to quench your thirst. But you can never grasp the river. It's impossible. And the same goes for the nature of existence. The same goes for the true essence of the divine. You can't grasp it because it is so much more than you. All you can do is simply hope to align yourself with it. This is where we get the idea of letting go, of becoming one with the stream, of floating down the river. You can easily try to do all these things to try to get more control of your physical surroundings, and what does it matter? Because nothing is physical. Oh, but Martin, of course, if I run into the wall, I'm physical, I'm going to hurt my face. Yes, you are. Because you think that that's real. You believe in this concept so fervently that you make it true. But the reality is that none of it is. You're simply allowing the colors to blind you, the sounds to deafen you. You can do a simple experiment to prove this to yourself. I have a white mug of coffee right next to me. There's no coffee in it, by the way. I did quit drinking coffee. But it's a coffee mug. It's got juice in it. It's white. It's, 5 inches tall. It's round. It's got a handle on it. The handle's black. It's got some writing on it. And it just so happens to meet the prerequisites of the framework that my brain has created to determine that it is some kind of vessel for liquid. And because of its shape, more than likely there's coffee in it. But of course, for one, there's no coffee in it. Number two, it's not white because white isn't a color. It is simply sending out all the colors of the rainbow. So it looks white to me. So I say this mug is white, but it is neither a mug nor is it white. Right now, it is simply an extension of my being holding a liquid. And so you see, the way that I had to explain to my daughter on how to get around this feeling of hurt, this feeling of being bullied, of being made fun of, was simply to tell her to join into the game. Because oftentimes when people try to bully others, it isn't because they want to win, it's because they have some innate desire to make themselves feel better for whatever reason. And they find someone that they feel might be an easy target. And see, when you allow these things to use you as a target, then they can, because you're it. You are creating the universe around you. So if you let yourself be a target, you will become a target. And so she was the target. So I told her, play the game. If this person says something hurtful to you, say it right back. Join in on the joke. Accentuate the joke. Because see, then the reaction isn't what's expected. If I'm very insecure about the way I look and someone says, oh man, you're so ugly and you're fat and I hate your beard and this, that, whatever it might be. And I'm insecure of myself for those same reasons. I also think I'm ugly and fat and my beard is terrible. Then I'm going to get defensive. The animal instinct's going to arise. We feel threatened and we fight back. But what if instead of fighting back, we join in? We say, you're right. My parents were so ugly, I can't help it. And then what do? Because see, then the person has nowhere else to go. They get no satisfaction of making fun of you anymore because you're not fazed by it. It means nothing to you. So see, this is what it is to be walking, standing, sitting, lying down. Everything you do is Zen. None of that matters because none of it is real. What's real is this. What's real is right now. Not what you did yesterday or the week before or last month or who your parents were. Not what you're going to do tomorrow or next week or who you'll be in 20 years. That's all imagination. It's all conceptual. None of it means anything because you live right here, right now. You know, I see all these arguments all the time on Twitter, for example. Twitter is, of course, the easiest place to use as an example because people are anonymous, right? So they can say whatever they want. Well, they feel like they can. Sometimes you see this in real life, right? People have certain beliefs and they feel like they want to exercise those beliefs and show them off to others. So they go out and protest whatever it might be. They protest Black Lives Matter, Blue Lives Matter. They protest this side or the other side. They protest this belief or that belief. They protest this book or that book. And why? Are you so insecure in your very essence that you have the need to attack others? You're doing yourself a disservice. You argue the characteristics of good and evil, of black and white, of in and out, endlessly. And for what? Because you get nowhere. There's another Zen poem that I really like. And it goes something like this. The wild geese do not intend to cast a reflection. And the water has no mind to keep their image. I think we're going to wrap it up here. I want to thank you for listening. The future of the podcast really hasn't changed. The only thing that's changed is the way that I approach doing these episodes. So some weeks, you might see that I have 2, 3, 4, 5 episodes. And sometimes you might not see an episode for a month or 2 months. And the reason is that I don't want this podcast to be a chore. I don't want this podcast to be in addition to my daily suffering. This podcast is about sharing ideas and sharing experiences and having open discussions and being as truthful as I know to be. It's not about sharing knowledge or spreading gifts of spiritual enlightenment. All of that are fallacies. That's all conceptual. This podcast is about knowing how to be human, that it's okay to be sad, and it's okay to feel down, just as much as it is to be happy and dance around. That's what philosophy is. That's what spirituality is. It's not about imparting your ideas onto others, but rather about learning from each other. So, we'll wrap it up here. Feel free to email me, martin@thealchemicalmind. You can find me on Twitter @mindalchemical. Patreon @patreon.com/mindalchemical. And that's going to wrap up this episode. Thank you all for listening. And as always, remember that you are it. All of it.